This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I am Grace Cavalieri. My guest is Danielle Giuseppe, and she's the author of Blood Autumn. That's her 15th book of poetry. And here she is with an opening poem.
Music is a child of the grass. Your skin is translucent in the still air of this room. Clay is prerogative, eyes are derivative. We live in the shadows of immense hands, like death that will take our sex away. Bridal days and wedding nights of grace and youth, and doors opening in women. Music is a child of the grass and teaches us the cost of frostbite. We can't separate the misunderstandings or wash dishes in the music box. We talk and spend the word on our burning hands. A cinder of a joke catches in our throat. You laugh to hold on to the hurrying waters. A fern is a fan that resembles a rainbow. And the last ghosts of Indians are asking for food in the amber waves of dying grain.
An American classic, Danielle Giuseppe. We are on location in New York in her beautiful studio, surrounded by the proper accoutrement for Danielle. Her own paintings, her own drawings, her own sculpture, her books. The memories of all the great poets she has known, including Allen Ginsberg. And I would just like to say that Danielle is the preeminent woman literary activist in America. What do you think I mean by that?
Well, perhaps it has to do with the fact that I did an anthology called Women on War, International Writings for Survival in the Nuclear Age. And I did win the American Book Award for that because it was the first international compendium of women's writings against war. And because I was an activist with the civil rights movement from the age of 20 when I was abused by the Klan, and also I did a world compendium of literature called On Prejudice, A Global Perspective.
I remember that very well, and I think that what I've come to thank you for is changing women from victims. So I'm here in presence, your presence, to say that is something I want to go down in history with your name. You changed women from victims to visionaries, and you're still doing it. So this is Danielle Giuseppe, and I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're on location in New York, and we're going to be hearing some of her really very profound, erotic, and free poetry.
Thank you. You're very gracious, Grace. And I know that you, too, have been a proponent of women's rights with your wonderful poems about Mary Wollstonecraft. And I've become very interested in women free thinkers in particular. Right now, I'm working on a book on Emily Dickinson, who was really a free thinker in her time. She resisted all the born-again Calvinist Puritanism of her day, and so I feel in the tradition of great American women poets with you in that we are trying to see women as visionaries and pay attention to their visions rather than just to their oppression, which everyone knows about. This is a poem that I've written more recently. It doesn't exactly have to do with that theme, but it does have to do with writing poetry in general. And I think it's something that most poets can identify with. Rejection makes wings with each little death it offers. I've known rejection as much as you, and the love I wanted escaped on that winged horse who always flies higher from us as we reach higher and higher, heaven always exceeding our grasp. I've reached for love with words, longed for love, wanting to live forever on paper. enjoying the attempt in those brief moments when we know we are alive and words fall into new music that engulfs the smiles of those who want nuance more than loud sound that blasts the mind with dance. Still, what I've swallowed of love sticks in the throat with bitter glue of longing, as love happens only in moments which pass like ripples over liquid skies full of clouds that hide the sun, giving shade enough to make desire blaze. Eyes of envious gods want to pick at our moist flesh, and so we're not allowed to live forever, but hope, perhaps, our love, like Dante, Shakespeare's, or Millais, could live on in poems which sharpen the knife of mortality. Sometimes I feel my words are mere trash sitting at the curb in the rain, waiting to be collected before it spills into the gutter and runs down drains at the ends of streets into nowhere. Most of the time, we're trying to love and not loving, but we're trying. And when we stop trying, we're dead, even as poems that live sting us with memories of lovers who are gone with their words, living on in longing for love, so good, so pure, so full, so erotic with touch once felt, that it flees onto a page, or off into graves, or up flying higher after that winged horse who always goes higher, up and away, into the land of Pegasus' green pastures, where we can never go until we meet death chasing after that heavenly tail.
The voice of Daniela Giuseppe. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Did you hear the line, the music, the image, the scope? She was a dancer. She was a singer. She is an artist. She has been on the stage. And I think all of that comes to the fore when I hear her work. And we want you to know that Blood Autumn is coming out, Bordighera Press, this year, 2006. She has an e-book titled Symbiosis. And she has many books. Women in War, we're saying, was put out and is reproduced right now.
Yes, it's in an all-new edition from the Feminist Press with all new writings added from especially the Mideast and the areas of war that weren't covered in the first 1988 edition.
Simon Schuster.
Simon and Schuster did the first one from Touchstone, and now the new one is from the Feminist Press with all new revised writings and a 30-page introduction to the world situation as it is today. And I've added much more international writing because there's much more translation now than there was in 88. And we know a lot more about the women writers of other countries. We still don't know enough, but we know a lot more than we did in 1988.
Daniela Giuseppe, and I know that you want to Penn Syndicated Story Award. It was Daffodils. I remember the title.
Daffodil Dollars. Yes.
Daffodil
yes.
Dollars. You've written novels. You've written stories. You've written e-books. How do you feel that you can venture into so many paths down the literary genres and not get vertigo?
Well, I suppose I just really don't think about it very much because I started with an MFA in drama. Oh. And my first pieces were plays. And then I went from plays to multimedia poetry for the stage. And my first grant from the New York State Council on the Arts was in performance multimedia poetry. I did something called Care of the Body, which had dancers dressed as anatomy charts doing yoga while images flashed on a screen behind them, and a long poem about all the crazy things humans have done to their own bodies through the ages. That was my first piece for which I won my first grant. So that really encouraged me. But then as I grew older, I had a daughter, I found I couldn't go out to rehearsals so much. So I started writing poetry more for the page.
Vagina Monologues was really preempted long before. They just didn't know that you were way ahead of the game. Your writing has always been about the rebirth, replenishment of women. And you use the body image, I think, succinctly to make spiritual points. And there's a great deal about your work, however political, which is, as I say, deeply sensual. Is that something the critics say about you?
Yes, they have said that. And I do that, I hope, without ever using any four-letter words. Mm-hmm. So it's erotic, but not what I would call, in the sense, sexy dirty, because mm-hmm. I think the word sexy is an abbreviation of sexuality. And so I'm more concerned with birth and death and how it's related mm-hmm. to the body and how we are sensual creatures. We live through our senses. We have no life without seeing, touching, feeling, tasting.
I feel that sensuality is the opposite of pornography.
Absolutely.
Because pornography is dehumanized and sensuality is, as you say, sending the poem out into the world with all of its facilities, its hearing, its sight, its smell, and we're going to hear another right now.
I think I should read, after that discussion, I should read a poem called The Sea Hag in the Cave of Sleep. It's a longish poem of about 6 minutes, but it really epitomizes everything we've just said. The Sea Hag in the Cave of Sleep. For all the bold and bad and bleary, they are blamed, the sea hags. That's a quote from James Joyce Finnegan's Wake. Words whirl her round in pools. I cling to my teeth, grinding mountains. She floats, I scream. She drops through an eternity of light. She floats again. I fall, calling for animals to warm her, pleading with trees to feed me. Darkness fills her like a carbohydrate. Ponds ooze. Crickets drone in black space. A snake slides over a rock. A seed is dragged to another grave. Human voices hum behind the stones. A vast, lonely conscience strains to give itself a name. The cave of sleep opens as she spreads her legs. The father enters the iridescent dark from which he came. Blocks of ice fall from his aging flesh. She turns to him to marry him and be his mother again. When she turns again, she is his son. The shine of his skin slides down her throat. Seaweed glides through my limbs. Kisses, kisses. Land and water come together in the mud of our lips, crawling with tongues that give touch to words. He swims into me in clouds of semen. Babies cry in our mouths. We float from the warm well in aboriginal kisses. Lizards nestle in bushes, hurting and loving leaves. Seabirds peck at tortoise shells. She feels how wet the earth is, nearly all water. Since she bled, there's been a passion finer than lust, as if everything living were moist with her. She knows the language of leaves as an animal blessed with it. In the trees is a clue to everything, and a happy one, like the genesis of estrogen. Ever since the first woman bled, plants cry when animals are murdered. Hands think as bees emoting sweet sweat. Apples are made for eating. Even mathematics is glandular, an algebra of feelings. Only wars are waged in the guise of pure perception, as though flesh were an alloy of aluminum or an easily isolated element. She takes off her dress. She lifts off her breasts. She has a talk with the sparrows who inhabit my chest. She is divided by contrary loves I've taken in. When I open her legs, a river of contradiction flows from me. Her limbs are estuaries, rippling toward my stomach, She drowns inside myself, longing for a god to speak to her from her lover's tongue, as they explode together in whirlpools of sperm and ova, spinning against the silence. When the baby came down out of her, it felt thick between my lips, squeezing out erect life. Its belly passed her clitoris as it came, with its cries of semen squirting from me. As its toes slid out, I was female again. A vast landscape accepts her with silence, as if it were my private garden to gather stones from her sleep. The phantom of age descends the staircase. In the middle of the afternoon, when light is blinding, I am looking for a man with arms like tree trunks, fingers, branches to turn my nipples green as spring buds. She waits outside myself for him to welcome her in. Or is it sleep, a peace deep as death she wants from him? She puts on feathers like a bird or a chorus girl. He can't tell which. If he comes to her bed, she'll be an orgasm of birds singing in wet leaves. The mouth of my dream will be open forever. I'll burst with a child, time hurled from her throat. She will paint a song beneath my eyelids to sing into his sighs. Down by the water, silver-haired witches are dancing. Down by the water, tossing their curls. Their breasts are eyes from which the sea rises. In their mouths the sea cries. They are kicking the sand made from our bones. Silver-haired witches, down by the water, singing and dancing, playing with bones. We take for each other the place of absent gods. We bargain for the eyes of fish to swim in an underground stream, longing for no death. These are our plum pits, petrified and strung. These are our beetles gleaming in the coal. We have come shining in ice from the mud, trailing seaweed in our wings of bone. We read, we write books from the deep spring of orgasm flowing in the flesh. We erupt in cataleptic fits as faith from the insane. We will invent love until the sea closes in. The phantom of age ascends the staircase. A vast landscape accepts me with silence. I gather stones from her sleep. She has knitted him a shawl and come to the frayed ends of history. His fingers are no longer primal myths needing her. Sea and shore mix in one giant sex. In the index of my womb, I find her face. She is no Spider Queen, after all. She's a green beast with arms of sorrow. Her whole body is a phallus. I came out from between my own legs into this world.
Daniela Giuseppe, we are in location in New York with Daniela. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and this is The Poet and the Poem. That was called The Sea Hag in the Cave of
Sleep.
And that proves to us that feminist writing is not male bashing. Feminist writing and political writing do not have to be polemical. They can be lush. They can be filled with sensuality. And that's the interesting thing about your work, and I think where you have been the leader of a certain movement in America. I've been watching this for some time. Do you think I'm on the right track when I describe you?
Oh, well, I feel very flattered about what you're saying and also very understood. Mm-hmm. And then I feel very loved because understanding is love, isn't it? Mm. And so it makes me feel very good to hear you say that, because what I was trying to talk about here is the self-actualization of the woman, how the woman gives birth to herself, how we as individuals all give birth to ourselves, and how the male and female are symbiotic in their relationship.
Is that what your e-book Symbiosis is about?
Yes, very much about symbiosis, about the male and female in balance as the creators of life. And life should come from love. And so that makes it very easy, because for me as a free thinker, there is no God but love. There is no anthropomorphic deity. And I do not, as Emily Dickinson said, I loathe doctrine and dogma. Mm. And so for me to just look at the nature of things, the beauty of plants and trees and the symbiotic relationship of, for example, in the lichen, of fungus and algae, and of man and women as creators of children. And so I just think that when we look at nature, we don't need to look at the dogmas of religion, because nature teaches all the lessons. They're all there. And that isn't to say that there isn't the vulturism of the sea. We have to be hard-nosed about it. We can't just think of pastorals with pretty flutes and dancing children, but there is also the vulturism of nature.
But there's a little Aphrodite in you as well. Let's have some more poetry and set it up for us.
Well, speaking of Aphrodite, that gives me a wonderful clue. This is a very recent one, written many years after the sea hag in the Cave of Sleep. And of course, I got the idea of sea hags from the James Joyce writings. Right. But and the universal woman, Anne Olivia Plurabelle. And that, of course, was a monologue, something you'll understand as a writer of plays. Mm-hmm. And that was a very long monologue. Actually, it was first produced as a play on stage, The Sea Hag, with three women, one old, one young, one middle-aged, all wrapped in the same seaweed costume as one three-headed hag saying the monologue. But here is a very recent poem, just written last year, called Old Aphrodite Rises from Her Porcelain Tub. She thinks of how easily supple rose petals bruise, how quickly flowers wilt. Naked, kneeling in the tub, her nether regions rising as she tries to rise. She doesn't feel erotic, but assailable. Does her aging body spurn her? As she kneels, balancing carefully to rise slowly, afraid of falling alone in her bathroom where no one would hear her, she doesn't feel sensual or sensuous as she used to. She doesn't dream of sex or passion, ardor or orgasm. She remembers a news photo of a woman kneeling as she's stoned by angry men. A story of a woman made to kneel by her rapist, a suppliant virgin sacrificed in ritual, a woman bent over river stones, alone washing clothes, surprised by her violator, a woman in a motel kneeling over, dead in a pool of blood as she grips her innards with the pain of an illegal abortion. She doesn't dream the substance of love poems as she kneels and bends, naked now and old, thinking of all the women who have assumed this suppliant pose, not only for men, but for their gods of war, in whose names bombs are exploded over cities and landmines set to blow off legs from children running in meadows, farmers tilling in fields. As she rises from the tub, she wants to look upward, raise her arms full of snakes and power, raise her arms heavenward, an ancient figurine, lifting arms like magic wands, splaying, spraying beams from each spread finger. She wants to invoke the vast mystery of outer space. as a proud suppliant to all that lives, arms thrust upward, palms open to light, even if she's nothing more than a temporal body with tired heart weakening as it beats inside her sagging breasts, trapped inside her second of sempiternity, just an old woman rising from the porcelain shell of her bath, alone inside her small chamber in a teeming city, looking upward at the ceiling and the light over the sink.
This is The Poet and the Poem. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're on location with Daniela Giuseppe. We're back, Poet and Poem from the Library of Congress, on location today in New York City with Daniela Giuseppe. She is a woman of social consciousness. She is a feminist. She has been a theater person, performer, creator, and painter. I'm looking at all of her art objects right here. Her work is a dialectic between what it is to be alive and an overview of the entire struggle. As a leader of the Italian-American writers in America, you have been one of the people that I think if you say a couple of names, your name will pop up right as one of the first ones. So for the last 25 years, I have watched this movement where you have tried to take people who were in the corner and brought them out center stage. And this happens because of your own heritage. Tell us a little bit about your background. I think your father was a politico.
Well, my father was actually a very struggling immigrant who came to America in 1913 as a boy, couldn't speak a word of English, absolutely poor. He had seven brothers and sisters. He raised them through the Depression. His father was a shoemaker. My grandmother, Lucia, was very loving. I think we got much of our inspiration for storytelling and writing out of Lucia, who used to tell fairy tales around the coal stove in our flat in Newark. Mm. My father grew up very, very poor, but he worked very hard to put himself through college and win the Phi Beta Kappa and the Sigma Psi while he was walking 6 miles every morning on a lame leg to deliver newspapers, 6 miles every night, and living on nothing but pasta and beans, pasta fazzule, as
sounds
we say.
Sounds good to me.
But he really worked terribly hard to become somebody. And he wasn't so political, actually. He was a chemist. He was a chemical engineer. And he invented Sylvania Soft Light and the Blue Dot for Sure Shot. But because he was working for a corporate lab, he never earned more than a dollar from his inventions, though the corporation made millions. And he was very prejudiced against. As a small boy, they would call him Little Guinea Gimp and names like that. And it hurt him terribly because he believed in the American dream. Mm-hmm. So actually, I'm much more political than he ever was. I found my own way to sociopolitics as a result of the prejudice that he suffered. And that's what inspired me to do On Prejudice, A Global Perspective, and to struggle to bring more knowledge about his heritage to the American people.
That won the World Peace Foundation Prize, I have to say, also.
Yes.
And I always think of you, though, as a daughter who is very much loved. Now, where these stories have come from are just osmosis over the years, but you were extremely devoted to your father, isn't that right?
Oh, yes. He was my inspiration in every way. He was so bound to teach himself English and get rid of his Italian accent that he read Shakespeare cover to cover while tending a parking lot nights, putting himself through college. And as I was growing up, 10 years old, he was reading me Romeo and Juliet, Cervantes, and so he read me a great deal of classical literature as a small child, and he developed what we would call a beautiful broadcast radio voice. He was only 5'6" and lame and very sickly and thin, but he had the voice, the thunderous voice of a broadcaster. He was gifted with this operatic larynx, and he used to just hold forth so beautifully reading Shakespeare and such.
Well, I know that your work and perhaps his inspiration has resulted in many awards for Italian-American writers, publications, the Bordighera Press. You have been a founder of many prizes. And Via Folio, what is that?
Via Folios is an imprint of Bordighera Press, and it is publishing Blood Autumn this year. It also published my poems Going On and my book Word Wounds and Water Flowers. And I went with that press because I had some name recognition so that I could bring some more young American Italians into print. And I started publishing first Eggs in the Lake with Boa editions in 1979. And that book was in print for many, many years, Eggs in the Lake. And then I started to help Via Folios of Bordighera Press.
I think
Press.
You had more than one from Boa.
Yes.
I do remember that.
Yeah.
You have had books from major presses, which I think is pretty interesting because many of us that have a pile in our closet have gone the small press route, but you seem to have been blessed by major presses as well, which is not a bad thing because of distribution.
Oh, yes.
I'm watching a piece of paper here in my hand, which tells me about a new award, and I think that's the Lifetime Achievement Award from Hofstra University.
Well, actually, it was from the Italian American Educators Association, and that's run by Vito Di Simone of Hofstra, and he runs a festival there every year of Italian-American writers at Hofstra University. So I was their featured reader this past September, and I won in 2003 the Lifetime Achievement Award for education and for creative writing.
And now for permanence, your verse is engraved in marble on the wall of Penn Station, along with Allen Ginsberg and Walt Whitman. Not bad.
I was
Not
thrilled
bad.
By
Let's
that.
Let's have another poem.
Oh, okay. Let's see. Well, recently I've just become a grandma, and I was studying with Marie Ponceau. For the first time in years, I went back to study poetry, and I thought, well, if I'm going to study, I have to study with a woman older than me so I can look up to her. So I took a class with Marie Ponceau because I hadn't written in form and rhyme in years. So she was teaching us this little form called a tetrina, which is invented by a friend of hers, and I was about to become a grandma for the first time, so I wrote Grandma's Reverie. Why does the reverie of becoming a grandmother confer such a fresh and lavish thrill? It's not come by my particular will. I won't be the mother who tempers the will of this unborn child in this Sumerian time. A grandmother thrills at knowing life waltzes on, incepting new thrill. Though most don't cognize their far ancestors' thrill, or really know their great-great-grandmother's will, or who, if, or what made her a grandmother, loved. Being a grandmother gives will to thrill.
Tell us about the form.
Well, the tetrina repeats words. It uses three stanzas, and the three words, grandmother, thrill, will, in this case, are repeated in each stanza in different sequence. And then, after the three stanzas, all three words are used in a final line, separate from the three stanzas. And that's a tetrina, which Marie Ponceau was teaching in her workshop. Actually, I wrote another tetrina, which I think is a bit smoother than that one, actually. And this one I dedicated to Marie Ponceau because she liked it. And also, I must say, I studied with her because here at 86, is she now? Still going on, writing, getting prizes. It's wonderful. She's sort of the Stanley Kunitz for us women. Marie Ponceau, going on at 86, still teaching and writing and publishing and winning prizes. So I dedicated this to her as an example of someone to look up to and who gives us the strength and the will to go on. Because we have to admit that our culture doesn't value its aging women or aging men perhaps as much as it should, although I think the aging women have a harder time of it. So Marie Ponceau is a wonderful vision for all of us. Lost tree of heaven, a tetrina. Between my childhood house and the house next door was a strip of concrete where a lonely ailanthus tree, older than the houses, stretched arms toward the sun and seemed to smile into my window filtering sun, especially in spring when screens opened the door, letting in zephyrs to stir new leaves of the old tree. And tiny aromatic white petals danced from my tree, as if it were given snowflakes from the sun, to sprinkle softly down on me, small in the open door, to heaven's door, where I'd finally live above the tree in sun.
I love that one. Danielle Giuseppe and I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're in New York on location. And she doesn't need a textbook because if you look around her place, we have anatomically correct paintings of flowers, wildflowers, domestic flowers, and they show up on the page, I see. So you know of what you speak. You know nature, right?
Yes. Well, I believe, like Emerson and Dickinson did, that nature is the proper study for us and that science is really, for me, a religion because the intricacy of natural creation is so phenomenal. One doesn't need a mythology. Mm-hmm. It's so amazing, the wonders of how things live in symbiotic relationship and how everything on the planet is related to everything else. And we're living in a very dangerous time when we're destroying the sustenance, our very sustenance and the sustenance of air, land, and water for the children. And that was why I appeared in an anthology called Only the Sea Keeps, which was to benefit the people who suffered from the tsunami. And then after all of those thousands and thousands of people died in the tsunami, we were hit by Hurricane Katrina and all these other natural disasters, the earthquakes in Pakistan and India, in the Kashmir region. And it seems to me that we have really got to pay attention now to the fact that global warming is definitely upon us. So I contributed these three poems to this benefit anthology called Only the Sea Keeps, which is edited by Judith R. Robinson, Joan E. Bauer, and Sankar Roy, and available on the internet on a website called poetryforhumanity.org. So this is a poem written in order to, you know, say something about these natural disasters and our need to see us as one huge interconnected being here on earth. The dead for whom we sing. Clear day, so cool, so bright. The sunset seems to weep tonight, for they are dead and gone. Lovely trees, green and serene, sway with a dirge and weep, for they are dead and gone. Shock makes gazers wipe their eyes as thoughts grow from the grave, for they are dead and gone. Sweet spring full of new days and roses, a time when wonder is revived in us, with music that begins and ends with breath, for they are dead and gone. Only the spirit of love and loved one lasts beyond its season and never grows cold, though the whole world turn to water or coal, as all that dies lives now and only now in us who feel it, see it all before us, laughing or weeping, like the dead for whom we sing. They make the longest demands, because we die forever and can't live or love upon command. In this vast galaxy, in this huge and bustling world, you were given only a speck of time in which to love, in your aborted life, sister, brother, father, mother, daughter, son. You slowly burgeoned and sprouted from your chrysalis to die too soon, sweet trace of nectar on your lips, as all of us delicate as butterflies. Gone too soon, reigning too briefly to understand our power or our beauty, our scepter stilled, pencil silenced, just as we're fully bloomed. Earth Song. We are eyes of leaves, ears of mud. We see sun set and rise, hear bird songs and wind sighs. We are eyes born of the sea. We are living souls of her. In her womb there are no nations. Her children are one rainbow of light. We yield to her. We are the prism of her sight. We breathe the breath of one. One universal bowl of water, one home to all of us. She is the mother of all. She bears the sun and is daughter and lover to everyone. Born of her seas, there are no enemies. The seed dies to be born in fruit. What is the life of a flea? The meaning of a flower? That it be as we, all of her mud and seas and seeds, blooming, blooming wondrously, from fingers, roots, swamps, trees. We are the eyes of leaves. We are the ears of the dead.
From Only the Sea Keeps, that's the voice of Daniela Giuseppe. I'm Grace Cavalieri. This is The Poet and the Poem, and we're talking about feminism, we're talking about consciousness, and we're talking about poetry, and they all seem to go together. I feel there's no difference in the war that we have within ourselves and the bridges that we try to cross to the world. They say that women own the earth and men own the world. But I think you managed to put the two together. I think you said, I'm not settling for just being the Mother Earth thing. I'm not allowing the men to just be in charge of war and awards and movements. I think I'm going to combine them both in one lifetime. That's what I see.
Yes, yes. I really don't feel like an angry feminist who's trying to make women behave more like men, but trying to reach some sort of symbiotic understanding. Mm. And these last poems I read are deliberately very simple. I meant them to be simple and universal and hopefully profound in their meaning and accessible to anyone who would read them. So I was so thrilled that they were quoted in the preface as a result, because I wanted to write them very accessibly. We're living in a time, and I've been through my time of experiment and abstraction in poetry, but I think we've come through a time where poetry in America has been quite abstract, and the poetry most paid attention to was very abstract, expressionistic language poetry for a while. And I think since 9/11, people are returning to more accessible poetry with a socio-political content. That doesn't mean that it has to be rhetorical, because one can write a bad love poem just as one can write a bad political poem. But to raise some of these human issues to the place of poetry.
What do you think is your own historical tradition? Other than observable science, which I see you got from your father, and the scientific bent, which I find in all of your work, but your own historical tradition, do you really feel a sense of connection to Italy?
Well, in the sense that we always heard the stories of Galileo, and my grandfather's name was Galileo, and we could not avoid knowing how superstition and the church was trying to hold science back. Mm-hmm. And then, unfortunately, that's happening again in our time. But I think people like Emily Dickinson, who, by the way, was one of our most scientific poets. She studied chemistry. She studied botany. She knew everything about flowers and birds and chemistry of her day. And she really, like Emerson, was saying, we don't, in order to worship creation, we should get out and look at it and study it and not stay in the dark rooms of churches listening to dogma, but studying science, because that's the creation that we should respect. Mm-hmm. And if there's a God, that's God's creation. We should pay attention to it in the sunshine, out in nature. And that was a whole transcendental movement, which I think is the best part of our American history. And I want to be part of that tradition of Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson, our two great poets. And since they both wrote in such differing styles, we as American poets have the right to write in any way at all, from the very tight lyric of a Dickinson to the long prosaic line of Whitman, to sing in a rhapsodic way or to write in a very sparse lyrical way. And I do try everything, being the jackass of all trades that I am, having been a classical actress. So I come from the tradition of having for years recited Shakespeare and Congreve, mm-hmm. and Racine and various classical playwrights.
I want to ask you about the Emily Dickinson work. Are you going to be writing poems in her voice, or are you going to be writing poems about her? Tell me exactly what the new book is going to be.
The book is an historical novel based on new research about her life. One Ruth Owen Jones has written a new thesis on who she believes the master really was. And the master was a scientist,
set
a horticulturalist.
Tell us what the master is. Our readers may not know. Right. Our listeners may not know what you mean by master. Yeah.
Dickinson Scholars, I'm registered with the Dickinson Scholars Registry, and we talk about ED for Emily Dickinson, and we talk about the master, who was the mysterious figure in these three love letters that survived among her poems. And they're very poignant letters begging for attention from her, quote, master. She calls him master. And also in her poetry. And now I believe that the master was William Smith Clark, who was a chief botanist and horticulturalist of her day. And he was also a colonel in the Civil War. And so I'm writing a novel based on those facts.
How do you start that novel? Just how do you begin such an enterprise?
Well, I studied a great deal about Dickinson and the 19th century. I've read all the biographies, the Habiger, the Johnson, the various biographies written about her. I've studied the 19th century, how disease was rampant, people were dying left and right, half the children died of cholera and typhoid, and how science was struggling against Calvinist Puritanism, and Emerson and all those people were part of a transcendental movement. So I've also written an essay called Emily Dickinson, Lover of Scientist and Science and the Dark Days of the Republic.
But in the novel, you have to have characters.
Yes.
And are they fictional characters?
No, they're based on real characters. Her brother, Austin Dickinson, her Colonel William Smith Clark, her sister, Lavinia, Susan Gilbert Huntington Dickinson, her sister-in-law, all of those characters
who
are real.
Why is it a novel?
It's a historical novel because I'm filling in between fact. What I'm dramatizing fact, like a playwright would dramatize, make the characters speak in dialogue. But I use a lot of Dickinson's own words in the novel, and she had many, many letters. Only a third of her letters exist. She was a huge letter writer, and we have a huge volume of her letters extant, but most of them were destroyed.
Are you a little afraid of the scholars when you start to apply fiction?
Oh, yes, this is a very controversial issue. Mm-hmm. But as I say, I am a Dickinson scholar. I'm registered with the Dickinson Scholars Registry, and I've certainly read enormous amounts about her in the 19th century and the Civil War. She was much more aware of the Civil War than we realized. Those were dark days of the Republic.
How do we have new information?
Well, Ruth Owen Jones, who is a scholar and who is a descent at the, she's a guide at the Dickinson Museum. She lives in Amherst. She was all of her life. She was president of the Amherst Historical Society. She's written a new thesis upon which I am basing my novel.
So we only had so much information, and it's more or less a new view of the information we have. Is that the way you
say
it?
Well, it's a new view of who the so-called master was. And why it's important is it changes the reading of the poems, so that when she says, on the house on the hill, that's where paradise is, the house behind the house on the hill, that was where he lived. When she says, neighbor and friend and bridegroom spinning against the shoals, that was when he almost was part of a drowning as he went south into the Civil War on some ships that were lost on the shore. So we read, and when we see the word will, it's a pun on the name William. So when we read her poetry, we have a whole new slant, and it comes alive. Some of the more elliptical poems come alive.
When will this be done?
It's almost finished, and I will start marketing it soon. I think it's going to be a very important book, which will change the reading of Dickinson.
How did you accomplish this? Did you wake up every morning and say, I'm going to sit here from 8 to 10 and just tough this out? Did you do it stream of conscious? Did you outline? What did you do?
Well, first of all, I was at a writer's retreat, Wellspring House, which is a lovely place for writers to go on a hill in Ashfield. And I discovered William Smith Clark was born there in that little village on a hill about a half hour from Amherst. And I started whenever I went there to my writer's retreat to visit the Emily Dickinson Museum. And I became very involved in reading about her. And you know, I think I was so weary of all the socio-political work I've done all my life, the marching, the being beaten up by the Ku Klux Klan when I was 20, these huge, huge compendiums of international literature on issues of war and peace and prejudice that I've done. I needed a rest. So I've always loved Dickinson's work, and I became so involved, I began reading and reading, and then before I knew it, I was writing a novel. Now, I don't exactly outline it, but I do tremendous amounts of reading, and then I sort of make a rough outline.
We're going to go back to the poetry of Daniela Giuseppe. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and this is The Poet and the Poem. We're on location in New York.
As when some silenced singer hears her aria. This is a sonnet in the Petrarchan style for Vittoria Colonna of Naples, Escia. She lived from 1492 to 1547. She was the first European woman to publish a book of poetry. She was a friend of Michelangelo. Just as the first European woman to earn a doctorate was an Italian woman as well. So this is dedicated, a sonnet in Petrarchan style, dedicated to Vittoria Colonna of Naples, Escia, who lost her husband in a war when she was very young and in love with him, and she spent the rest of her life writing sonnets about that. So, as when some silenced singer hears her aria, or creatures crawl riding foam to hurry back to salty home, as oceans pound fruit to pecking pipers, or shells keep tunes in ear-like chambers, filled with sand and sea to roam, like songs rejoicing feathered nest and comb, as warm eggs crack chirping hunger, and a child slithers forth to touch, smell, see, hear earthly cries and laughters, pushed suckling free from nurturing womb. My tongue is loosed beyond a private caroling. My pen prances, urged by mysterious love, as if it had no part in what is sighed. As earth sings praises through me, my eyes are green seas, red skies, wild flowers, a child who dances well when loved, beyond the pain of men's tribal wars, pride, threatened suicide, and bloody rivalry.
Daniela Giuseppe. She writes powerful work, and she reads it with great power. Do you have a tiny goodbye poem?
Yes, I do. The young girl who chattered without stopping leaps in your heart. She's lost among lizards. When she broke her glass hair ribbon, all the shops in heaven closed their doors. In the silence of the snowy streets, you hear a sad voice, mature and cowering, calling from a nearby alley, warning you. You place your hand over your mouth, where the three silk stitches of her cry smothers dryly.
The voice of Daniela Giuseppe. This is The Poet, The Poem. We are produced by Forest Woods Media. Post-production is by Mike Turpin of MET Studios. Associate producer is Kenneth Flynn. The Witter-Binner series is brought to you by the Humanities Council of Washington, D.C., the Witter-Binner Foundation for Poetry, and the National Endowment for the Arts, because a great nation deserves great art. You can hear this series on www.loc.gov/poetry. Our engineer is Ken Flynn. I'm Grace Cavalieri.